Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. It's 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, we'll join National Public Radio for All Things Considered. This evening, the curator of New York's Museum of Modern Art talks about a new exhibition that celebrates turn-of-the-century Viennese art. So that's at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered, followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. With me now on Fresh Air is Harvey Pekar, creator of the American Splendor comic book series. He describes them as adult comics, sort of like illustrated plays or monologues. Until now, the only way to get them has been shopping in specialty stores or writing to Pekar, but Doubleday has just brought out his first book featuring a sampling of American Splendor's 11-year history. American Splendor is an autobiographical comic, mostly about the details of Pekar's working-class life in Cleveland. Some of his stories describe states of mind like being too depressed to drag himself out of bed to get to work. He's worked as a hospital file clerk for 19 years. Other stories are vignettes on subjects like being driven crazy by the person ahead of you in the supermarket checkout line. People like Wallace Shawn and Sun Ra make cameos in his comic strips. A recurring theme is Pekar's frustrations about losing money on his self-published comic series and his cravings for some recognition. Comic book stores are more interested in superhero adventures than in...
Don't be nervous, Terry.
than in Pekar's ruminations.
Everybody out there loves you, you know?
Okay, yeah, but he's been lavishly praised by literary critics. In The Village Voice, he was compared to Dostoevsky and Lenny Bruce. Did you like that?
Sure, I liked it.
Who wouldn't like that?
Sure, they're both good guys, you know.
And, well, let me welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thanks a lot.
And tell everyone who's interested that your American Splendor series is published by Doubleday.
It's true.
And let me quote something you said. In 1982, you said, "I'm 42 years old. I've been writing for nationally distributed publications for 23 years, and I'm still an alienated schlep like I was when I was 19. Still true?
Well, things are getting better. Things are getting better. I'm married again. I'm happy to say, and my life is getting to be a real pleasure, let me tell you, folks. I'm getting a little more recognition for this comic book. I'm starting to break even on it, and things are looking up, you know. I don't have to work so hard on my job anymore. They got things a little more equally distributed on the job, you know, where other people do their share of the work, so I got a nice supervisor, and what can I tell you? You know, you should have it so good. That's all I'm telling you, folks.
You describe your comics as adult comics. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean they're aimed at adults. I don't mean that there's, you know, like they're sexually explicit. That's what a lot of people, you know, there's not much of that in my books. What little there was of that was in earlier stuff. Not that, you know, that stuff offends me, but, you know, it's just, you know, that's not the kind of thing I concentrate on in my stuff. You know, but my stuff is about, Well, I'm writing autobiographical stuff, and I'm using myself as every man, in a sense. I think that every author, in a sense, can only write autobiographical stuff because he only perceives the world through his own, you know, his own brain and his own senses. So I wanted to make this stuff as accurate as possible. So, you know, I didn't make up so-called fictional characters, you know, or make up, you know, composite characters. I just, you know, wrote about myself and my own experiences that I thought people could relate to. And I wrote about, the difficulty for many working people just getting through a so-called average day. I not only write about, you know, like people that would be called ordinary people, although I don't think anybody is really ordinary, but I wrote about experiences that are far too often taken for granted. I think that, you know, life is difficult. In fact, on the cover of my last comic, I said something like, in this issue, life is a war of attrition. And I think it is for many people. So, and I also write about the humor of everyday life, which I think far surpasses the humor that most stand-up comedians deal out.
Well, to give us all an idea of what you're doing in your comics, why don't I ask you to read an excerpt from it? And you don't hear a lot of comic book readings, but I think that this will work. So there's one that we've selected that I'd like
to ask you
to read. Maybe
Certainly.
You could describe what's happening in it before you start the reading.
Well, I hope Phil that Fiorello LaGuardia doesn't roll over in his grave, folks, and I hope you got that joke. Here it goes. This is a story from, called The Waking to the Terror of the New Day. And it's about how I, you know, sometimes, I'm a, you know, like, it was so difficult for me to get up and go to work. I mean, day after day, I'd, you know, like, I'd get up and I'd feel sick and I'd drag myself to the job, you know. And I think maybe a lot of people might feel that way. So I'm sitting in a bathtub and I'm thinking to myself, what am I living for anyway? What have I got to show for it? Shit gig, no old lady for months, crib that's falling apart, and no relief in sight. I know I got to get out of this bathtub, but I don't feel like going to work. And every day I go in anyway. Except for that one day I quit that door-to-door salesman gig. That just wasn't worth it. Then I think, it's so nice in this water. I know I'm going to get out of it, though. Then I think, sometimes I wish I could freak out, have a nervous breakdown, anything to get away from the same old routine. But I know I won't. I got this far, and I guess I'll make it the rest of the way. But what's the sense of hanging in there if you got to live like this? Oh, well, if I freaked out, I'd have to start from further back than this. It could be worse. Then I get up out of the tub, and I think, well, here goes nothing. As soon as I get out of the tub, you know, this was a poorly heated apartment. It's the middle of winter. I start shaking, think brr to myself. Then it shows me getting dressed, and I sticking a finger through one of my socks. And I say, let's see, what kind of splendid threads am I going to put on today? These things are falling apart. I guess I'll have to get some new clothes pretty soon. Shit, I hate to spend money on clothes. People spend so much money on clothes, but they don't take care of themselves. They're nuts. What could be more ridiculous than fat slobs spending a lot of money on clothes? They're going to look lousy anyway. I was down on fat slobs at that time, folks. Now I'm not. Then, you know, then I go on to say, now for a terrific breakfast. And I'm holding, you know, like, you know, a box of the sugared cereal. See, I'm noted for eating junk food, you know. I'm notorious for that. It's one of my curious qualities, you know, that people get a big thrill out of, you know, and like to laugh at me because of that. And I'm, you know, starting to eat this cereal. I think, it ought to be slow at work today. Maybe I'll get a chance to rip off some stuff from the stockroom. I ought to be able to sell all I can get. Serve that fool right for the lousy money he's paying me. I say, well, I better get going. I put on my coat. I put on my hat. And I walk out the door thinking, that gig is getting to me. I got to find something else. Gig means job in jazz man's terminology for all you squares out there.
Well, this is all done in comic book form, and comic books are more usually the place for superheroes, and you know, and here you are, Mr. Everyman, describing about how depressed you are and how you don't want to go to work, but you're going to drag yourself in. Anyways, was it hard to find people who got what you were doing in the comics?
Well, I think comic book people, you know, people that like comic books, you know, have difficulty relating to my stuff. Because comic books are, you know, they're as good a medium, you know, as good an art form as any other, you know. But comic books have had, you know, they're a case of arrested development. They, for some strange reason, have become practically a one-genre medium. They, you know, they're escapist. They deal strictly with, pretty much with fantasy, whether it's... you know, like talking ducks or, you know, superheroes or, you know, it's all fantasy.
What did you choose to do comic books instead of writing plays or novels? Because after all, you don't draw. You contract illustrators to actually draw the stuff. So why'd you want to do comics instead of just writing?
Well, I think one reason is that, you know, I used to know, well, I met Robert Crumb a long time ago, and I used to, in fact, he's several years younger than me. I met him when he came to Cleveland in 62. And, you know, of course, when I was a kid, I had read comics, so I was familiar with the medium. You know, I collected them. I was, you know, when I was, you know, like 10 years old, I was a fanatic comic book collector, as a matter of fact. So when Crumb came in 62 into Cleveland, he was doing, you know, he showed me some of the stuff he was doing, and he was doing a thing called the Big Yum Yum Book, in which he was using animal characters, but... it was actually like a, you know, satire of contemporary American culture. There was a lot of, you know, references to the beatniks at that time. And, you know, so he, you know, Crumb is a jazz record collector like I am. And, you know, to tell you the truth, that was primarily what we used to talk about. We used to talk about records and I was actually tighter with his roommate, Marty Pauls, at that time than I was with him. But we still, you know, we got to know each other. And both of those guys, Pauls and Crumbs, were in the comics. And they got me thinking about this stuff, you know, and I thought. And then Crumb went out and got famous in California, you know, with this underground comic book stuff. And I was thinking, well, you know, this is fine, you know. And, you know, it was really good stuff, the underground comic book movement. But I thought, you know, more can be done in the movement. It doesn't just have to be, you know, about a subculture, you know, sex and dope kind of stuff. It can be about any, you know, anything. And so I thought I would, you know, I thought I could write good stories about my own life. Now, prior to doing comics, I used to be like a street, well, I still am kind of like a street corner comedian, you know. And, you know, I find that it's real easy to, you know, translate, you know, some of my raps. And believe me, I had shticks, you know, and still do. I mean, I had, you know, standard bits. If I could come up with a bit that would make somebody laugh at work, if I could and if I can, I'll run around and tell it to 15 people, you know, just as long as they're separated. You know, I like to make people laugh, you know. What can I say? And
So you wanted to start, you saw R. Crumb doing these things, and you wanted to start doing them too.
Yeah, well, but I thought I would do stuff about everyday life. And comics translate very easily into, I mean, rather, oral raps translate very easily into comic books, more easily, you know, stories, more easily than into straight prose, because, you know, you can use the panels to time and punctuate your stories like a comedian uses silence. And I started out with that, and I showed some of the stuff I had written in storyboard form to Crumb, you know, with stick figures. Back in 72, he was in Cleveland with a guy named Bob Armstrong. They were staying at my house. Armstrong was another very fine, you know, cartoonist. And they liked my stuff, and they started doing it. And, you know, the more I looked into it, the more I realized that, my God, here's this field that's just, you know, as good as any other. I mean, like, it's almost a priori. What can you say? I mean, there's no limitations on how good the words can be in comics or how good the drawings can be. You can make them as good as you know, as you want to, or as good as, you know, anybody wants to. It's just that they have a stigma attached to them, and, you know, people have been avoiding them. So I got more and more serious about doing this stuff, and I just thought, this is a tremendous, wide-open field. You can do all sorts of things. I could think of all kinds of things to do in comics.
And you could publish it yourself. You didn't have
right.
to worry about whether the New Yorker was going to publish
right.
it or whether a book company would want to put it
right.
out or not.
Yeah, well, at first I tried to get other people to publish it, and I got a few stories published, but the underground comic book business was going under as the subculture was dying out, you know, the counterculture, I should say. And, you know, so I just decided, you know, I'll save the money and I'll put it out myself. And if I lose money, it's okay. I can afford it because I didn't, you know, live lavishly, you know. So that's how I did it.
Was there any precedent for what you were doing, which was basically writing the story with little stick figure illustrations and giving it to illustrators like R. Crumb and saying, okay, you do the drawings for it?
Oh, sure. I mean, that goes back a real long way. I mean, that's the rule rather than the exception, like in comic books, I think. And, you know, not only in comic books, like you take comic strips, like, you know, Ring Lardner, you know, wrote You Know Me, Al. That was a column of his, you know, about a baseball player, you know, he called the Busher, you know. And he wrote comic book stories called You Know Me, Al, too, about the same character, and had other guys illustrate them. But that's very common. I mean, you look at Marvel Comics now, they got a tremendous division of labor. They got a guy who's a letterer and a penciler and an inker and a color guy and, you know, and a guy who, you know, conceived the story, and a guy who actually, like, you know, in general, and a guy who actually wrote it. And my God, it's ridiculous.
Each of the artists who draws you, and there's several of them, has a different visual conception of who you are and what they want to say about you when they draw you. Do you want to describe some of the different conceptions that artists have come up with of you and how you feel about the different ones?
Sure. Well, let me also say that, you know, I'm pushing for realism in comics. You know, that's what my work is. Now, you can tell stories in various ways. You can, you know, using various narrative techniques, you know. But I want realistic detail, and I have, you know, but I want realistic detail in my work, you know, all the time. I want that to be a constant because people can identify with that, you know, and it really hits home with them. You know, that's the kind of people that like my stuff, is people that that can identify with my stuff. But I digress. You were asking about the artwork. Okay, Crumb's got a cartoony style. Generally, I try and discourage guys from using a cartoony style, but Crumb's got such a, you know, wonderful sense of observation. You know, and he puts in all these details that really make the stuff be real, you know, seem realistic anyway. But in general, I like, you know, my stuff to be, you know, real, you know, like drawn realistically, anatomically accurate, you know, as accurate as possible, because I think that complements my stories. Now I have, you know, I work with a variety of people, and I don't, I like to encourage, you know, like individualism, you know, as long as they draw me realistically. Okay, excuse me.
Oh no. I just wanted to reintroduce you. My guest is Harvey Pekar, and he's a writer and the creator of the American Splendor comic series, which has just been collected in a new book, which is also called American Splendor. Since your stories are so personal and autobiographical, why did you come up with the name American Splendor, which is a much more all-inclusive kind of title?
Well, I was being ironic, you know what I mean? Because people would hardly think of my life as splendid. I mean, now you want to know where I came up with the two words? I mean, I can give you the origins if you're into origins.
Sure.
All right. Well, my logo is sort of a, like a satire of the old 1940s DC comics, like when they had comics like All American Comics and Star Spangled Comics and stuff like that. So that's where the American came from. Splendor just seems to me to be a kind of a, I don't know, it just hits me as funny, you know? Like, you know, some people think the word Cleveland is funny. I think Splendor is a funny word. You know, and I remember I saw that movie Splendor in the Grass. And although I thought it was a pretty good movie, I thought it was a, really ridiculous, funny title. So I just used the word Splendor. Maybe in the next book I'll use a U in it to, you know, give it the British spelling, you know. That'll really make it splendid.
You had been a jazz critic and a very obsessive jazz record collector before you started doing the American Splendor series. Did you give up all the jazz collecting and writing when you started doing comics?
Well, I was pretty, you know, for reasons of, you know, having nothing to do with my, you know, interest and love for jazz, I was pretty sick of writing jazz criticism about, you know, by the early 70s. And I was a jazz critic for, you know, from 1959 to 1976. But until I got going on comics, you know, I kept on doing jazz criticism and actually did some of my best work in the last several years of my career as a critic. But it was such an unrewarding profession. I mean, not only was I not getting paid, but, you know, like I remember writing for this one magazine, and these guys owned a record store, and they, you know, I would write 5,000-6,000 word articles for them that I'd killed myself on, you know, and they would. They wouldn't even give me a discount on the records I bought from them, or they'd screw up my orders. So that was what the stuff was coming to, you know. It was like adding insult to injury. And it's also it was a very difficult form of writing for me, the most difficult that I've ever done, because I took it real seriously, and I, you know, like to get all the technical details correct. So I would listen to a passage over and over again till I could describe it accurately. I would spend enormous amounts of time, you know, working on this stuff. And, but I kept on doing it after I was tired of it, you know, just so I wouldn't feel like a total schlep, like I was just only a file clerk. It, you know, was good for my morale to see something get in print. But once the comics, you know, started moving and going and people, you know, caught on, you know, I just didn't need to do it anymore. So that's why I dropped it.
I was wondering if doing comics put you in touch with a different scene than writing jazz criticism, but it strikes me you're probably not involved in any, quote, scene anyways.
Well, you know, I don't know. When I was writing jazz criticism, I mean, it was like just completely isolated. I didn't hear from people, anything like that. I mean, I knew a few local guys that were, you know, jazz musicians or critics or fans, and, you know, I used to hang out with them, and I still know the guys, you know. But writing comic books has really enriched my life. I get considering the, you know, relatively small sales figures of my own book, although the Doubleday book is going good, I get an awful lot of mail from people, a lot of it from people who say that, you know, hey, I thought I was the only guy in the world that was going through this experience, and, you know, by writing about it, you know, you made me feel better, you know, and which is what I'm, you know, it's one of my motives, you know.
You self-published the American Splendor comic series. Did you have to sacrifice a lot in order to come up with the money to publish it yourself?
No, not really. I mean, what I did was I just, you know, I always had a lot of extra money because I lived so cheap. I mean, I had a six-room apartment that I lived in from 1971 to 1977. I only paid $115 a month for. Give you an idea, like, you know, how cheap I lived. I wasn't making great money, but in fact, I wasn't even making what people consider good money. But, you know, for me, it was all right. And I just had nothing to spend my money on. I used to spend it all on records, but I just decided. I wrote about in my book about how I quit collecting records. That's too long a story to get into now. But I did quit collecting records, and I had all this excess money, and I just saved it up in maybe a year. Saved up, you know, a couple grand or something like that, and, you know, put out the book. You know, I pay the artists, not much, but I always pay them something, you know, and I'm paying them more and more. I split up the money with them, you know, that I get from, you know, Doubleday. So, you know, things are going okay.
The cover of American Splendor says, "From off the streets of Cleveland comes American Splendor." Is Cleveland considered to be a joke among readers? Does that get a laugh, saying Cleveland?
Well, Terry, I guess you know it does. Sure, you know, Cleveland is, like, you know, years ago when I was a kid, I used to listen to these radio programs. You know, all they'd have to do was say Brooklyn, and they get a laugh. You know about that, Terry. Well, maybe you're too young to remember that.
That's my city, Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know, Terry. Yeah. That's why I said that, Terry, you know. Little identification there, you know. Try and make you feel what it's like to be from Cleveland. It's like what it used to be from Brooklyn.
I used to live in Buffalo, and that had its share also.
Yeah, Buffalo, yeah. There's a big debate going on along the shores of Lake Erie as to which is the worst town, Cleveland or Buffalo. They're very similar. I've been to Buffalo. I got treated like a king there. It was a wonderful place for me. Anyway, yeah, you know, they started making jokes about Cleveland around the late 60s, you know, with that laughing thing. And you know, when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire, and there were all these ludicrous things that happened politically. You know, like we had a mayor that he set his hair on fire one time, and his wife refused to meet with Richard Nixon when he was in town because it was her bowling night. I think that was admirable, by the way.
I would think it would be a bit of a disadvantage for you to live there in the sense that the publishing industry is in New York. When you were writing about jazz, Cleveland has never had the reputation for being the center of jazz. Do you feel like it's hurt you in any way to stay in Cleveland?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I'd have to live my life over to tell you that. I mean, I don't think it set me back that much. I suppose if I lived in New York, that would have been a big help. But living in some place like Chicago or Philadelphia, you know, bigger cities that are not currently the whipping boys of the nation, that I don't think that would have meant much to me.
Why have you never moved?
Because I got a job there. Because it's not that bad of a town. It's okay. You know, it's not like a... First of all, I'm not saying I couldn't get used to a small town or living in a in a rural area. But, you know, Cleveland's not... I mean, you know, it... Hey, you know, it's a big city, you know. They've got one of the greatest orchestras in the world. Some people think it's the greatest. They got an excellent art museum. They got some pretty good educational, you know, facilities there. They've got an outstanding public library. Cleveland's fallen upon hard times lately, but Cleveland used to be a very progressive city, and there's a lot left from the times when it was back in, starting from around 1912 when the mayor was Tom Johnson, and There's a lot of good stuff about Cleveland. There's a lot of ethnic variety. You can learn a lot living there.
You grew up in Cleveland.
Yeah, I grew up in Cleveland.
Your parents were Polish Jewish immigrants?
That's right.
And were you brought up religiously?
Well, no, not really. My father was real religious. He was a Talmudic scholar, but he used to work all the time. He had my father and mother had this mom and dad grocery store, and my father, would go to work before dawn, go down to the market to buy produce from the farmers and bring it back to his store. He'd come home, you know, maybe 7, 8 o'clock or 7:30 at night. He'd be exhausted. He'd read the Jewish paper, you know, maybe, you know, read some, you know, religious books or something like that, listen to some cantorial records and go to bed. He didn't think it was his business to, you know, indoctrinate me. I think he, you know, or, you know, bring me up. I think he probably thought that, you know, that was my mother's job. And not only that, but he was, I don't know, he just thought it happened automatically. He thought I would automatically have the values of someone who came from a Polish shtetl. And it really, you know, upset and shocked him when I turned out I didn't.
Did you feel guilty about that?
No, I mean, why should I feel guilty about it? I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I used to feel bad about it. But I mean, you know, how could I be like him? You know, I didn't grow up in that environment. My mother, who also worked in a store, but not as long, you know, had more of an influence on me, I guess. But although she kept a kosher home and everything like that, she herself was not a religious person. She knew all about that stuff. You know, her father was a sheikhet, you know, a ritual slaughterer, a butcher, you know, and he knew a lot of stuff about, you know, he knew a lot about religion and stuff like that. But and so even though she knew about it, she was a political leftist, and I got, you know, my initial left-wing political orientation from her.
Your father ran a grocery store. Did he want you to come and work in it when you got old enough?
Well, my mother did, you know. My father, I don't know what he wanted. He never talked to me much.
What did it make you think of for your own life to watch him working in a store? Did it make you think that that was something you did or that you didn't want to do?
Well, obviously, you know, guy who works those kind of hours, you know, like, you know, there's nothing for him to work a 16, 17-hour day. And, you know, I wanted to get away from that. That's one thing I always wanted was just to, I didn't care about how much money I made a lot of times, but I wanted to work 40 hours. I didn't want to work more than 40 hours. You know, I mean, to see that guy do that, and then I used to have to work on Saturdays, you know, and after school and stuff, and, you know, sometimes I'd, you know, like I worked Saturdays from, like, you know, maybe 7 o'clock in the morning. I'd meet him at the store and unload the truck, and, you know, we'd come home maybe 9 o'clock at night, and I'd be, you know, just dripping sweat all over, and, you know, and God, I wanted to stay away from that.
How were you introduced to art and literature and music?
Well, I don't know, when I was a kid, I just read a lot, that's all. My father was I was just good at it, and I liked reading, so that's how I got into, you know, like, literature, and I just enjoyed it. It was something I enjoyed. As far as how I got into music I just started getting into jazz because, I like to listen to any kind of music. Cleveland, after all, you know, is a great musical town, you know, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that. And, no, it was really a big rock and roll center in the 50s. I was into that, you know, before I got into jazz. You know, Alan Freed is from there and some other guys who were, you know, there's a guy named Bill Randall who was a real, real influential disc jockey in Cleveland in the mid-50s. Who was from there. Cleveland was way out ahead of Philadelphia. I hate to tell you folks this, but we used to watch Dick Clark on American Bandstand, and he'd be playing these songs on American Bandstand in the 50s that had come through Cleveland like 2 months ago. We used to sneer at Dick Clark, if you could imagine anything that un-American, but that's the way we were in Cleveland. We didn't give a damn. And, you know, then I started, I bought this book about, you know, the history of jazz or something. And I started reading about these guys like Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong, and they just seemed like real colorful personalities to me. That was why I was initially interested in it. And then I got a few records and I started digging it. And I knew a guy that was a jazz trumpet player. I used to go over his house and we'd listen in the basement to records. And this guy knew his stuff, thank God. I mean, he really had a solid knowledge and he knew who was good and why they were good. And he got me going on the right, you know, on the right foot, and I just got into a, you know, I'm a compulsive guy, and then, you know, so I just, you know, got into it real heavy, you know, started, you know, reading everything I could and listening to everything I could and started writing about it when I was about 19.
How old were you when you started supporting yourself?
20.
You didn't go to college?
I had a few, you know, like, you know, I went a little bit, I worked for a year after high school, and then I went to finished about 3 semesters, you know, working part-time, and then I quit again.
Why'd you quit?
Why'd I quit? Well, I could say I quit because I got married, which I did. But the real reason I quit was because, you know, like when I was a kid in school, I used to do well in school, and I didn't think about it. You know, sports was a big thing to me then. You know, and the guys I hung around with, they didn't think anything about school, and it was no big deal. But I always, you know, wanted to be real good in something, you know? And, when I started to go to school, you know, I had different friends, and academic excellence meant something at that time. And I started doing real well in college, you know. And, you know, like the first semester, I got 3 A's and a B, and I wasn't even trying that hard, you know. And I got, you know, really into getting grades, you know, that, you know, academic competition thing, you know. I started pushing myself to a point where I got, you know, like catatonic practically, and I couldn't study. I was so nervous. I was just, from a practical standpoint, I could not go to school anymore. So, that's why I quit, you know. I just got a job, a simple job, and that's what I've been doing ever since. I just started to start from scratch. I had to start from scratch. And, you know, I was married when I was 20, so, you know, I had to make a living.
My guest is Harvey Pekar, who's the creator and writer of the American Splendor comic series, and they've just been collected, well, many of them have just been collected in a new book called American Splendor. You make it sound as if you get so obsessed with what it is that you're doing that with some things you just have to stop because it becomes too intense, too overpowering.
Yeah, you know, that's happened to me on a couple other occasions. You know, that's why I had to quit sports. You know, that used to mean a lot to me, and I got so overwrought about it and wanting constant praise and everything like that that I just walked away from it. But I don't know, you know, like I sort of hung in there and, you know, I didn't have great expectations for myself, so, you know, I wasn't really disappointed, you know.
Well, did anything beyond a 9-to-5 job seem accessible to you?
Well, you know, just one thing sort of followed another, you know. It was kind of strange the way I evolved, or, you know, my career evolved. Even this jazz criticism stuff was sort of like a kind of a fluky kind of thing how I got into it. I was corresponding with a jazz critic in New York named Ira Gittler, you know. And one time I hitchhiked in New York when I was, you know, about 19, and I went over to see him, and he said, why don't you start writing for this, you know, jazz magazine, you know, the Jazz Review? And, you know, I thought, you know, well, they're not going to accept anything I do, you know? He says, no, go ahead, try it. So I went back to Cleveland, and I wrote an article, and this was an excellent magazine, you know? But there was a magazine that just managed to scrape by. It only lasted about 3 years. It was the best magazine, jazz magazine, that I ever wrote for and that I ever knew of, except, you know, just wasn't a commercial success. So, you know, I sent them an article and they accepted it. And I started writing for them for about 3 years. And after the magazine folded, I sort of gotten used to writing jazz criticism and I liked it. And, you know, I just liked, you know, it made me sort of feel like a somebody, you know. And I kept on writing jazz criticism. I developed, just by my association with such an excellent magazine, it sort of opened the door for me to write for other magazines. And, you know, eventually, a couple years later, I started writing for Downbeat. And then I started getting, you know, I was into other subjects. And, you know, like I was, for about 5 years, that's how I did nothing but read history, you know. Like, I used to be an elevator operator, and I would just sit on the elevator and punch the buttons with a history book in my lap and read it. And so I wrote a few historical articles, you know, about African history and a couple political articles. And, you know, my interest broadened, and I tried to write about different stuff, you know, and I'm still doing that stuff. I write literary articles now, and I take that very, very seriously, and I work very hard at it, you know. Read an awful lot of novels all the time.
But throughout your adult life, you've had 9-to-5 jobs, and you've done your writing, and your record collecting, and so on, in your spare time on weekends and in evenings and days off. What's kept you at a 9-to-5 job? Have you tried ever to make a living with writing or with the other things you've done?
No, I never tried. I mean, you know, there was no question about my making a living, and the stuff I've done has never been commercially successful. When I wrote for Downbeat, I got $4 for a record review, you know. Maybe, you know, like once in a while I'd publish an article, I'd get like $60, $75. You know, the most I ever made as a jazz critic in 1 year was about $935 or something, and I wrote an awful lot of reviews for them. I would review records that nobody else on their staff would review. I review all these organ records all the time and stuff, you know. You know, so there was no question of that. you know, most of the time my work's been a labor of love, and you know, I've really enjoyed it. People give me a lot of credit for hanging in, and you know, they say, "Wow, you got a, you really had a lot of guts to hang in there and persist all these years," you know. But I mean, what was my? I don't take that credit because, you know, what were my alternatives? I had no alternatives. If I had just quit doing this stuff, my life would have been, you know, poorer for it, you know. So, you know, I did what I liked. You know, if the money came, it came. It was fine. And that, you know, that's the way I was and that's the way I am. Now, if I could ever make a living from these comic books, you know, like if it happened right away, overnight, you know, that some, like, for example, suppose, like, you know, some big movie studio called and said that we want to base a movie on your stuff, you know, and we'll give you, you know, like enough money that you can stick it in a bank and, you know, like live on the interest for the rest of your life. Well, you know, that'd be a jolt to me. I guess, you know, I would probably do it because I'm not that crazy about work, and I'd take the money and I'd probably quit work. But, you know, I mean, it really cuts me off from something real important to me, you know, contact with, you know, with working life. I mean, that's become part of my life. I'm not saying I'm an idiot savant or anything like that, but, you know, I've been a wage earner all my life, and I enjoy people. I enjoy working with people, and, you know, it gives me a sense of perspective about myself, you know, not to think that I'm so hot, you know, and to see other people's problems. I mean, to have that taken away from me, I mean, I would really have to, you know, probably try and find something that would substitute in some way adequately for that.
But, of course, the impression you get from the comics is how depressing it is for you to get up and go to work and how you really want out of the job.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I guess there's, you know, some ambivalence there, obviously. And it's actually, this realization has actually come on me, you know, fairly recently. You know, when I started to realize, you know, how important my job was, you know, and my connection to, you know, to the same, you know, to the life and the lifestyle that I write about. You know, I mean, I'm writing about life as it's happening to me, you know. It's not like I'm looking back on it or anything like that. And, well, even in, like, one of those early stories I wrote that's in the Doubleday book, you know, something that I wrote about, like 1978, you know, I spoke about my job in pretty much the same terms I'm talking about it now. How, you know, it gave me a sense of perspective, and, you know, I always realized that. But actually, the thing is that, you know, conditions on my job have changed a little bit, and, you know, it's made things more pleasant for me. That is a change. You know,
you include some of the people who you work with as characters in your comics. What kind of reaction do you get from them? Do you ask them for their permission first in case they're uncomfortable about being in print?
Yeah, very often I do. And people really like it. People are always asking me, why didn't you put me in there and stuff like that. I mean, I've even developed a standard line, you know, where I say, well, you know, give me a picture of you, and I'll get an artist to draw you in a background scene. And if I get a lot of letters about you, you know, maybe I'll give you a small part in the next story, you know, like that. You know, it's a lame old kind of thing to say, but, you know, they, you know, I mean, that people really, you know, after every comic book is out, you know, comes out, you know, people sometimes, you know, like half seriously, you know, like say, how come I wasn't in there? I've been knowing you all this time. I'm your friend. Why won't you put me in there? You know, I actually sort of feel bad about some of them. You know that I can't get some men.
My guest is Harvey Pekar, and he's the creator and writer of the American Splendor comic series, and several of them have just been published in book form, also under the title American Splendor, published by Doubleday. Well, in addition to being a wage earner, you're an employer in a way because you contract out your comics to artists.
Right.
To illustrate them. And R. Crumb, who wrote the introduction to your book, complains about how you have to browbeat artists into it because you can't afford to pay a lot of money. So how do you feel about being in the employer position, knowing that you're really asking a lot from people, but financially you can only afford to give a little in return?
Well, you know, I mean, I feel kind of bad about that. I try and pay as much as I can afford, but it's still not that much. And, you know, when I got my advance fee from Doubleday, I, you know, split it up 50-50 with the artists who were represented in the book. And, you know, like if I get a work published in a, you know, in a magazine, as sometimes happens, I'll, you know, I'll split the money up with the artist 50-50. But, you know, considering the time they put in, I feel bad that I can't pay him more. As far as being a boss, I don't like the idea of being a boss, but, you know, as a matter of fact, I've been offered promotions at work and I've turned them down.
So that you wouldn't have to be over somebody else?
Yeah, or, you know, well, there's a variety of reasons. The job I have is just perfect for me, too, you know. But, I wouldn't want a supervisory position. But when it comes to comics, the thing is I want the stuff done, you know, pretty much the way I want it. Now, I give guys, you know, a lot of leeway. I'm not a dictator. You know, I want them to express themselves, and I want their individuality to come out. But there's certain things, you know, like maybe I won't compromise on it. If a guy's misinterpreted something, I got to ask him to change it. If it's my fault, if I've explained it to him poorly or something, then I'll pay him extra money to make the change. But, you know, there's a few things that I'm adamant about, you know, not that much, but some things.
What's an example of something you want to change? Can you remember?
Well, I mean, it's
too picky to go into.
Well, nothing leaps to my mind.
Right, okay.
But, you know, it would be like if a guy would draw somebody in the wrong kind of clothing or, you know, totally off the wall, inappropriate stuff. I mean, I've worked with some guy, you know, I assume that some guys, you know, sometimes I work with guys a lot younger than me, for example. And, you know, like I, you know, like sometimes assume that they have knowledge that they don't have, you know, like about a particular social group or ethnic group or something like that. And once in a while, you know, I try and go over the stories very carefully with them before we do it. I have instructions on the scripts, you know, or which are, as I said, in storyboard fashion. And, you know, and I go over the thing panel by panel with them. But they, you know, sometimes they'll forget about something, you know, or maybe I won't explain it to them adequately or I'll forget to. And then, you know, there'll be some kind of an embarrassing looking screw up. And in that case, you know, I'll ask a guy to make a change, you know. A lot of it, though, I think has to do with the appropriateness of, you know, the way a person looks or, you know, the backgrounds or, you know, the architecture, you know, what the neighborhood looks like, you know.
You've gone to, according to the stories in your comics, you've gone through some periods of intense loneliness and other periods of, like, being married and happy in a relationship. You're married now. During which kind of period are you more productive?
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter whether you're miserable or happy.
No. No, the stories, it's real easy for me to write. The stories come to me. I just live and they come to me, you know? And, you know, so that there's no problem there.
Is it hard to be an obsessive and keep a relationship together? Does that get in the way at all?
Yeah, of course it is, because, for one thing, you know, a lot of times if I'm, you know, my mind's someplace else, I'm giving the people that I'm dealing with, whether, you know, it's my wife or a friend of mine, you know, I'm giving them short shrift, you know, I'm not paying attention, I'm ignoring them, you know, maybe not because I don't value them, but because, you know, like, I'm being jerked around, you know, by some other kind of problem, my head is being jerked in another direction. And, I in some ways I'm not the best friend, you know, like I'm very often a lousy listener because I'm thinking about something else or, you know, instead of looking at into some guy's face or something, I'll be looking over the top of his head or looking at the ground or something or, you know, or I just, you know, I can't wait for him to finish talking before I start my own, you know, rap. So, sure, you know, people like me are, you know, leave something to be desired as friends.
Your wife used to run a comic book store in Delaware.
Yeah.
Has she exposed you to comics that you weren't interested in before or weren't keeping up with? Because you're kind of removed from the whole comic book commerce.
Yeah, well, my wife, actually, it's interesting. The way I got to meet her was through correspondence. I told you I got a lot of letters, and She started writing me, we started corresponding, and then, you know, eventually, you know, we started calling each other over the phone, and, you know, a few months later we met and then got married. So, you know, comics have a lot of fringe benefits. She showed me what was going on, you know, today. She pointed out some things that people were doing, you know, sort of brought me up to date a little bit. But I have to say that most of the stuff that, you know, the mainstream kind of stuff, what passes for mainstream in comic books, which is flying people, you know, I can't relate to it. It doesn't mean anything to me.
You said you used to collect comics when you were young.
When I was a kid,
What'd you collect? What'd you like?
Well, at that time, when I was like, you know, 8 and 10 years old, I liked superhero comics at that age. My taste started to change, though. I started to like better comics. I'll tell you some good comics from the so-called golden age of comics, which is, you know, the 1940s, which was, believe me, was no golden age. If there was any golden age, it was, if there's a golden age, it's probably yet to come, you know, and I hope it does come. But anyway, people are real nostalgic about the 40s, you know, because of Superman and all those characters. There were some good people in comics at that time, though. One guy was, you know, Will Eisner, who did The Spirit. Another guy was a guy named Jack Cole, who did Plastic Man. Those are really kind of funny, you know, stories. Those were good. And, you know, I liked, then I, you know, I got older. I liked Little Lulu, and I liked, I thought that was kind of hip. And it's still, you know, look at it, it still is. And you know, the Carl Barks, the guy who did the Walt Disney comics, you know, like, created Scrooge McDuck and characters like that. He was good. But, then Mad Comics was pretty good, you know, in comic book form. That sort of was more, you know, adult-oriented, and you know, it was very important in that respect.
You've had to deal with comic bookstores because you publish and distribute your own work. Do you speak the same language as they do? Do you find that you're really not communicating when you talk with them because their idea of comics is so different than what you do?
Well, I sell the wholesalers, and they deal with the individual store owners. But I don't know. I mean, it varies. Some people, you know, they don't know where you're coming from. And other people, you know, surprisingly large number of people like my work. I think... that my work would probably do better, my own comic book would sell better simply if it was distributed better. And you know, non-comic book readers, people who are, you know, readers of novels and short stories, had a chance to get them more easily. Because my Doubleday book is selling well, you know. But the people that read it are, again, you know, like novel readers, you know, for the most part.
Let me ask you to describe and read the cover of the Doubleday book.
Well, the cover of the Doubleday book is sort of an attempt at maybe predicting the future. I'm sitting on a TV talk show, and I'm sitting in a chair, and there's a couple of people, you know, a well-dressed man and a well-dressed woman next to me that are kind of recoiling from me. And I'm sitting there with a work shirt on, a work pants, and a hole in my shoe, and my, you know, shirt open, you know, and my hairy arms and chest exposed, and my nose running, and I'm saying, "I tell you, Irv," that is, you know, the moderator is sort of looking at me. I call him Irv, you know, it's like Merv or Irv Kupsinet or something like that. So I tell you, Irv, if anybody had told me a couple of years ago when I was just a funky file clerk that I'd have sniff, snirk, excuse me, I got allergies, I say that parenthetically, that I'd have been up there here with you, blah, blah, you know, I go on. And then in another balloon, I'm saying, "Well, I always knew my day would come." So that's the cover. It's a real crowd pleaser. Crumb drew it. It's nice, you know. Helps sell the book.
Anything like that happen yet? Have you been on the big TV talk show?
No, I was on one TV talk show. I'm not a talk show. Well, yeah, I was on a TV. I've been on two TV shows. I was in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Well, you know, when they did a dramatization of my comic books. You know, there was a play version of it in Lancaster. And I was interviewed on TV in Harrisburg on a, you know, public TV station, you know, Harrisburg being very close to Lancaster and being a capital. And I was in, you know that. You're all Pennsylvanians here, aren't you? And I was also on a TV show in Chicago recently. So that's my sum total of my TV experience.
I know you want more recognition for your work and to be a to be able to at least break even because you've lost money in the past on American Splendor. Do you think that that day is going to come soon?
Yeah, well, like last year, I actually, when you throw in the double day advance, I made money. I mean, you know, a couple thousand dollars. I would have lost money if I hadn't had the double day advance, but it's looking like I'm going to break even anyway. You know, like if I, you know, sort of, I'm just hoping that if there's, if I ultimately, you know, like, am able to support myself with the comic stuff, that it's sort of a gradual transition, you know, or I might get the bends. I mean, I'm pretty slow to adjust and inflexible. And, you know, and I say, you know, if I got cut off from my job and things like that, I mean, it'd be kind of difficult for me. You know, there's a lot of people, you know, the working people that, you know, when they get, you know, they retire, you know, they don't know what to do with themselves. I'd know what to do with myself, but it's just that I'd miss this real, you know, there's, you know, the people that I work with, let me put it this way, and the, you know, I work in a hospital, I'm a file clerk, and I have a, you know, I go down, I find lost charts, you know, of patients, so I work real closely with the patients, I go down, and I've been working there for a real long time, and I, you know, it's a VA hospital, so, you know, you get people from all walks of life coming in, and I really like the patients, and I, you know, and I really like the people I work with, and outside of that, I don't have much of a social life, and I would really miss that, you know.
Maybe you'd never leave the house if you didn't have the job.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think I would.
Can I ask you to read the last...
What, hypothetical contract?
Yeah. Would you do that one for...
Sure.
Maybe you could describe a little bit what's happening. And this is one of the American Splendors that's featured in the Doubleday book of Harvey Pekar's work.
Well, okay, hypothetical quandary is a story about... well, what happened was, to give you some background information, a woman from another big publisher... and a native Clevelander, this woman was, wrote to me back in 1983 or 84, you know, sort of asking me about my feelings about them publishing some of my work, as Doubleday was later to do. And, you know, I got pretty excited about it. I've gotten excited about a few things, actually. I have this sort of history of people, like there have been people that have contacted me about movies based on my work and stuff, and... but everything was, you know, has fallen through. So this woman, you know, I wrote, you know, when she wrote to me, I wrote her back right away and waited, and I didn't get a response from her. And eventually it, you know, kind of bummed me out. I was kind of let down. So, the scene is set, it's Sunday morning, and I'm walking to my car, which is parked in front of my, you know, back of my house. And this story, by the way, is illustrated by Robert Crumb, whose work with me has become progressively more realistic. You know, I'm talking about from an anatomical standpoint, the characters are not exaggerated. They don't look so much like, you know, the Popeye characters and stuff like that. So I'm walking to the car and I'm saying, that woman from that big publisher never got back to me. Guess she wasn't serious. Probably wanted a free book or was too lazy to look for my stuff on his stands or something. So then I get in the car and I'm driving and I'm thinking to myself, what if she'd been serious? What if they'd have published my work and it sold well and I'd have made enough to support myself as a writer? How important is that to me? So I'm driving down into this, you know, ethnic neighborhood, going to a bakery. I'm thinking it'd be nice not to have to get up every morning and go to work, to be able to read or work on stories and articles whenever I felt like it. But then I'd sort of be out of the struggle, sort of in an ivory tower watching the mainstream of life go by rather than participating in it. I'd be alienated, but I wouldn't think I had the right to feel bad about it. I mean, I'd be a well-paid, famous author. What right would I have to complain about everything? See, I'm famous for kvetching, folks, complaining. Maybe my writing would suffer. I've got a pretty unique viewpoint now. I'm a writer, but in a lot of ways, I've got a working man's outlook on life. I'd have to as long as I've been working at regular day jobs. So, I'm walking into this ethnic bakery, and I'm pointing to, you know, to some stuff in the showcase. And I'm saying to the lady who's working there, a couple of those and a rye bread. So while she's, you know, filling the order, I'm thinking, still, maybe I'm making too much of this. As long as I'm alive, I'll be finding interesting things to write about, meeting interesting people. If I lived a different life, I could still write about it. Then I'm shown, you know, walking out of the bakery, you know, it's just, there's a silent panel, you know, where you get a chance to sort of chew over what I'm saying, you know, about this ambivalence I'm feeling about my job, which I guess I've expressed today. Then I think, but would it be as interesting a life? Maybe it'd be too bland. But then knowing myself, I could always find something to get shook up over and write about. Let's face it, I'm not going to become a mellow man overnight, no matter what happens. So then I'm, again, walking down the street. You see the ABC Auto Glass Company there. And then I think, oh, well, it's all hypothetical. That woman didn't call me back. Then I sniff the bread. And in the last panel, I'm thinking to myself, sense of satisfaction. Ah, fresh bread. In other words, life goes on and I got to get back into the mainstream of life and, dig on my bread. So that's it. That's the story,
Is doing these comics almost like therapy in a way, because you get to work out all these things on the page and you even get to play yourself in a way?
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I think, a lot of things are almost like therapy to me, right? Writing other things has been very enjoyable to me too, it's not like, going in and some shrink or something and make a clean breast of things or something like that. No, because I'm real, when I'm writing these things, I'm not so much thinking about, like emptying my soul and, dumping all this stuff out as writing good stories. And, there's a certain amount of work and, dealing with technical problems that I'm concerned about. So it's not that much catharsis for me.
I really enjoy your comics, and I want to thank you a lot for being with us today. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
My guest has been Harvey Pekar, and he creates, writes, and publishes the American Splendor comic series, which is illustrated by several artists, including R. Crumb. And selected American Splendors from its 11-year history have just been published in an anthology by Doubleday. And in the past, it's been a little difficult to find American Splendor because it was only specialty stores that carried it, whereas this is an actual bookstore-type book. It's called American Splendor, The Life and Times of Harvey Pekar, and I'll spell his last name for you. It's P-E-K-A-R, Harvey Pekar. And he lives in Cleveland, and American Splendor is an autobiographical comic. And thanks again for being with us. It's 5:3. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Schuylkill westbound, 40 minutes between Montgomery and Belmont. Eastbound jammed, 45 minutes between Gulf Mills and Gladwin. They have some new traffic patterns in effect, and you're going to take a little while to get used to them. Traveling north on 95, slowing into Ben Franklin Bridge, slow again exiting at Woodhaven Road. At Center City's 15th and Market, there's a report of a car on fire there. Into New Jersey, slow on 42 south between 130 and 295. A minor delay at the Ellisburg Circle on eastbound Route 70. Heavy again approaching Route 295. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded by the Sussman Organization. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, my guests will be Wanda Wigfall-Williams and Nora Coffey, and we're going to discuss hysterectomy and its after effects. So that's tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guests will be novelist Chaim Potok, author of The Chosen and Davita's Harp. So hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Jay Goldman and Ron Barron were the engineers. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Amy Sallet. Assistance today provided by Marty Moss-Cohen. Danny Miller and I are the producers of Fresh Air. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up from National Public Radio.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
There's a key moment in Viennese design around 1902 where all that tendrils of vegetative growth that you associate with Art Nouveau are really wiped off the map, and everything gets painted white and black and turns into rectilinearity and geometric style.
Vienna 1900, the city, the period, produced seductive, haunting art forms. Tonight on All Things Considered, the Museum of Modern Art's biggest show of the year.
And these stories, the House Senate Conference Committee begins work on the tax bill.
The nation's second largest steel manufacturer files for bankruptcy.
City workers in Philadelphia defy a back-to-work court order. The workers keep on striking.
And Nigerian musician Fela Anokolapo Kuti. Now this news.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. House and Senate negotiators began work today on drafting a final version of the tax reform bill. The 22 members of the conference committee met with President Reagan and were then given an inch-thick book outlining the differences between the House and Senate versions of the legislation. Despite those differences, both sides say they're confident a compromise can be worked out. Congress today voted overwhelmingly to reaffirm $11.7 billion in across-the-board spending cuts that were made last month. The cuts made under the Graham-Rudman balanced budget law were invalidated by the Supreme Court. House leaders estimated that without ratification, $20 billion would have been added to the budget deficit. Despite a back-to-work order, striking Philadelphia garbage haulers refused to return to their jobs today. Pat Ford of member station WHYY reports.
The court back-to-work order essentially makes the strike illegal. The workers could now be jailed or fined for continuing to stay out on picket lines, but that apparently doesn't bother them. Not a single trash collector obeyed the order. A contempt of court hearing is scheduled for tomorrow morning and may...